It was surely part of the war. We have data. We have speculation. Aiden shrugged. Which apparently is enough. He met her gaze as he darkened the walls to opacity. Aiden had been insufferable enough alone aboard the Lodestar, operating his working group with minimal support from the battle group and the general. Since Pandem Nigh, however, Aiden had become respected by both the military and New Republic intelligence. It had masked his most vile traits. She hadn't seen him shout or curse for a while, but she couldn't help but read his easy confidence as smug arrogance. Yet he also appeared more competent than she'd given him credit for. The assignments he doled out to Alphabet Squadron were sensible and consistent with the overall strategy they'd agreed to. His team of analysts regularly revealed paths to military victory that would have otherwise remained invisible. If he hadn't held Quell's life in his hands, she might have respected what he was accomplishing. "I received word from my superiors about the reconnaissance question," he was saying, and Quell forced herself to watch his lips and listen to the words. "It's about what we expected. Polite praise for our work and an emphasis that we're in no way to blame for the fact that virtually no New Republic battlegroup has captured an enemy system in weeks. But there's no extra resources to go around." "Well," she said, "I'm glad the war didn't grind to a halt because of us." "Reassuring, isn't it? But it means the working group is stuck here, even if there's a lead to follow." Aiden was the only person Quell knew who still referred to Alphabet Squadron as part of the New Republic Intelligence Working Group on the 204th Imperial Fighter Wing. She supposed he had the right. He had founded the thing. "What about Vanguard Squadron?" she asked. "Any chance we can borrow them for a scouting op?" "Possibly." Aiden shifted aside a data pad blocking a holo projector built into the desk. He tapped several keys, and a series of images coalesced out of glittering blue dust. A star system, a shipyard, a technical schematic, along with lines of text that Quell couldn't read from her angle. But Vanguard's on a mission to try to ameliorate the shortage of starships going around. Special mission from Syndulla's special consultant, Lyndon Javes. "Professional rivalry or personal?" Quell asked. It was a stupid thing to say, but Aiden smirked. "The man likes to second-guess the rest of us, even when he's not invited. Frustrating trait in someone who's not always right." She decided she'd tested her leash more than was wise and quickly pressed on. "So, we can't be sure the message will reach Shadow Wing. We're building a trap we can't bait with any confidence. We've got time, and I've got options. All I need from you is a list of possible sectors." They turned to the real work of the day. Aiden pulled up incidents that had been flagged by his own analysts, by New Republic Intelligence HQ, by military droids, as fitting parameters indicative of shadowing activity. One by one, Quell and Aiden reviewed them together. They dismissed an ambush over Skako as too sloppy to qualify. Even without Grandmother, Quell announced, they wouldn't be stupid enough to get caught in the gravity well. And the disappearance of the Bantha's charge on the Rima trade route as too unremarkable. "If we start tracking down every lost shipment some merchant blames on tie attacks, we deserve to fail," Aiden grumbled. Other sightings showed more promise. A mole inside the Pike Syndicate reported that a badly damaged Quasar Fire-class cruiser carrier had arrived at the Jindyne shipyard seeking assistance. The source was reliable, but the information scant. Quell added Jindyne to the sightings map and tagged it with a medium confidence indicator. New Republic agents at Jarbanoff, by contrast, could offer numerous descriptions of the TIE fighters that had attacked that planet, but the strike lacked the typical signatures of a Shadow Wing attack. Whoever did it was good, Quill said, as Aiden pulled up images of burning disassembly plants and rescue workers in radiation suits crawling over downed patrol craft like maggots on a corpse. She was surprised to find her mind at ease, conjuring no images of carnage from her tenure with the 204th. But there's no precision to the targeting. Poor pilot discipline, if you watch their formation. Nothing we'd normally associate with the unit, even if Grandmother is no longer enforcing standards. Possible they're changing tack? Aiden asked. Possible, Quell said. But without a reason to think so, I wouldn't build a plan around it. I'll spare you the gruesome images of the radiation burns, then. I'm not concerned about their flying habits in any event. They marked the map, agreed to a low-confidence indicator, and proceeded to review a massacre at Anx Minor. Thorough and bloody and entirely in line with what Shadow Wing had done at Boshen, albeit distant from all other sightings on the map. And rumors of a repainted ghost tie along the Coda Spur. After looking at the details of the latter, Quell asked to see a list of known surviving Imperial aces to cross-check. Not today, Aiden replied, and that was the abrupt end of the topic. When they'd finished marking the map, Aiden wrinkled his nose and nodded. We'll pass it to the droids, see if anything comes of it. He tapped a key, causing the hollow to vanish with a flash that filled Quell's vision with spots. We've got weeks before our deadline passes. That's a long time for a message to wind its way through the galaxy. Quell nodded. Anything else? How's your squadron faring? She straightened her back and squinted at him. Pardon? Aiden stood from his seat and stepped to a cabinet at one end of the office. He opened the metal door, stared at the liquor bottles inside, frowned, and closed the door again. Ito mentioned wanting to check in on the others. I don't want to waste their time unless it's necessary, so as squadron leader, how are your people? They're fine, performing better than ever. Lark and Chaddock are getting along. Tenzin's no trouble. Frankly, I expect they're under less stress than they've been in years. Aiden snorted and leaned against the cabinet, as if putting on a show of nonchalance. Is that right? Quell tapped a finger against her shirt, feeling the bulge where a memory chip hung from a chain around her neck, the last scrap of D6L, the droid that had been destroyed at Pandem Nye after dedicating its existence to Quell and her mission. We're winning, she said. They're used to being outnumbered and on the run. Now they're making bombing runs and returning home to a hot meal. There was a knock against one of the walls. Quell could see a silhouette through the opaque surface. Aiden ignored it. And Kairos? Quell tried to discern what exactly Aiden was asking. Kairos had been the man's first recruit. She didn't know how long they'd worked together, though he clearly knew some of her secrets. Kairos is Kairos. Fair enough, Aiden said, and opened a door in the opaque wall. Nasha Gravis was waiting, staring into the office with gunmetal eyes. Her slight frame and smooth, fair skin gave an almost childlike impression, though Quell couldn't guess at the woman's real age. Certainly, she had the jaded edge of a veteran. Formal complaint just came in, she said. The children of the Empty Sun are feeling neglected. The cultists on Katadra. If we bombed one of their compounds, tell them to take it to General Syndulla, Aiden said. Apparently, the same smugglers who were moving supplies to the Empire, the ones we just captured, were also assisting the cult. Gravis spoke without sympathy or judgment. There's not many of the children on Troyth, but they're enough to carry some weight with the civilians. Fine, Aiden said. See if you can smooth things over with the discretionary funds. You're in charge of the project. Gravis nodded, flashed Quell a look like a sniper preparing for murder, and stepped out. Aiden shook his head in apparent disdain. religious types are springing up all over the galaxy. This lot says they're a religious fellowship, but cult will do. Word from command is, try to avoid interference. Lucky Gravis getting the job to deal with them, Quell said. Considering where she transferred from, I'd say so. Quell understood Aiden well enough to know exactly what this meant. Not, let's talk about Nasha Gravis, but I have secrets you don't. Does she know? Quell asked. Does she know what? Does she know about Necronus? Does anyone on your team? There were many possible reasons for Gravis to disdain her, but the truth was the best of all. That's really not what you should be worrying about, Aiden said, and when he smiled, it wasn't half as oily as it should have been. I'll make sure no one knows who doesn't need to. It was a threat in its way, because no one needed to know until Quell caused trouble. But this was how the conversation always went. No matter who she asked about, Gravis or Aiden's superiors or General Syndulla. They spent a few more minutes discussing the operations to come, and with her options curtailed, Quell found it easier to concentrate on business. It wasn't until she left Aiden's office that she found her mind wandering again. Nasha Gravis escorted her to the turbo lift, as if afraid Quell would peer over someone's shoulder at a classified data display. As she stepped through the doors, Quell said, Aiden trusts me more than you do. She waited for a reaction. She hoped to see some glimmer in Gravis's eyes, some sign that Aiden had shared Quell's crimes with her, or not. Something to tell Quell how boldly she wore her shame. Gravis only smiled darkly. It's not about trust. Aiden likes you more than I do. Quell began laughing as the turbo lift doors shut. Chapter 4. Subsurface Rot. 1. As a child, Soren Keyes had visited the ruins of Navash Hall in the war plans of Fadal. The decay of ages had occluded that window into the planet's ancient past, as had the anachronisms, the custodial droids and velvet ropes and explanatory plaques, but he'd perceived grandeur nonetheless. Wandering those alien palaces, knowing that every vast chamber and kilometer-long passageway had once possessed a name, served a purpose for a forgotten people, he had felt awe for the first time in his young life. Years later, when he had stepped aboard his first Star Destroyer, the broad, endless corridors had returned the metallic scents and glass-like chimes of Navash Hall to the forefront of his mind. He had felt awe again, knowing that a battleship required more workers to construct than even Navash Hall. That although generations of Fedalese life forms had carved and mortared and etched those palaces, tens of thousands of Imperials had worked factory lines and engineering pits to bring the Star Destroyer to life. Soren didn't think of himself as an artist or historian, but on a visceral level, he was drawn to the Empire's grandeur, as he had been drawn to the achievements of that lost Fedalese civilization. The cruiser carrier Eri was not a Star Destroyer. It inspired no awe, and Soren was reminded as much every time he walked its cramped halls. It was an efficient, functional vessel, with equipment visibly packed into every alcove, and cabling run close enough to overhead lighting fixtures to cast odd shadows onto every surface. No Imperial cadet, Soren thought, had ever aspired to serve aboard a Quasar Fire-class cruiser carrier, no matter how useful such vessels were in the larger scheme of the Navy fleet. He descended a ladder on his way from the bridge and hesitated to drop his booted foot to the plating below. For an instant, he considered taking an alternative path to the wardroom, then he dismissed the notion as cowardice and proceeded along his path, soon reaching a four-way intersection near the center of the deck. Standing in the center of the intersection, oriented 90 degrees from Soren, was a humanoid figure cloaked in red leather and fabric. A plate of black glass served as its base, and it possessed a stillness that made obvious it was either statue or machine. Periodically, Soren knew, the figure would turn to face one of the other halls, like an antique timekeeping device cycling through the hours, or a primitive compass pointing to some place of galactic importance. The intersection around the figure was decorated, anointed, Soren thought, distantly recalling lectures on the rituals of the Fetalese, with a hodgepodge of objects. Tucked into the space between piping and the corridor walls were rank plaques and officers' caps and bottles of contraband liquor. From a cable hung a line of medals and ribbons that swayed in reply to the thrumming of the Ares hyperdrive. On the walls themselves, writing etched by utility knives and laser torches filled whole panels, names of the dead from the 204th and elsewhere. It was as much a memorial to the Empire and its fallen as it was a shrine to the entity at its center, the red-cloaked messenger who had come to Shadow Wing after the Emperor's death. The messenger had spoken only once, so far as Sora knew, ordering the commencement of Operation Cinder before falling silent. Since then, it had remained with the unit, following Grandmother to Pandem Nai and escaping where she had not. It had been in the same intersection aboard the Airy when Soren had arrived. Its presence troubled him. It was a machine with outsized influence, using the name and voice of a dead emperor who had strangled the galaxy as much as nurtured it. But the reactions of the Ares company disturbed him more. The shrine grew daily. Pilots bowed their heads and fell silent as they passed. Soren had considered proposing it be moved to a cargo bay, but he feared that would only create dismay and distrust. He met the faceless gaze of the machine as he passed. It said nothing. 2 minutes later, he arrived at the wardroom. The chamber was dominated by a single table and left barely enough room between table and walls for seats, let alone for the occupants of said seats. Outside, the Ares corridors had been almost silent, aside from the ever-present hum of the engine. Inside the wardroom, a dozen voices competed for attention.
"These attacks on Yaga Minor are suicidal. Cheroy's complaining about falling behind on that competition with Squadron 5. Is that really..."
"Rebel propaganda, all of it.
Maybe they are winning, but the idea that we'd believe..."
Soren crept along the edge of the wall and took his seat at the head of the table. Gradually, the others fell silent. He swept his gaze over the faces before him. The 204th 6 Squadron commanders and the acting commanders of the cruiser carriers Airy and Allegiance. They all looked back at him, stoic or impatient or concerned. He made an effort to even his breathing. He steepled his hands against the table's edge. He owed them all his best effort.
"The operation at Jarbanoff was a success," he said,
the acoustics of the room flattening his voice.
"The objective was completed with zero casualties and minimal damage to our fighters. Our engineering crews report that no fewer than 7 of the TIEs we retrieved can be restored to working order, while the remaining 2 can be disassembled for parts. That brings us significantly closer to a full fighter complement, a necessity for any further action."
Even to Soren's ears, it didn't sound like much of a victory. No one applauded. He thought back to when Devon had rallied the citizens of Tinkertown, teaching them to defend themselves against the local gangs. Life had been considerably simpler then.
"Successful or not, however," he went on, "we do have much to learn from the operation. No one here was trained to worry about the energy cost of missed shots. Nor are we used to fighting an enemy capable of deploying vast forces at a moment's notice. Nonetheless, A failure to adapt will cost the wing dearly. We refine our methods with every mission. All of us.
There was silence in the room. A few of the squadron commanders nodded. Gaborone stiffened in apparent discomfort.
I thought,
he proclaimed from the far end of the table, that this meeting was a state of the war update.
Soren studied Gaborone. The commander of Squadron 4 was round-faced and curly-haired, with a mustache that hadn't been in style in the core worlds during Soren's lifetime.
Soren had known Gaborone for many years, and still thought of him as the man Moff Kuvern had sent to replace Colonel Nerys as leader of Shadow Wing. Despite Nerys's stubborn unwillingness to retire, however, Gaborone had served adeptly and shown neither ambition nor disloyalty. No matter their differences, Soren respected him.
I'd intended to leave that topic for the end, Soren said. We can't do much good for the Empire if we can't stay alive ourselves.
But,
he leaned back and dropped his hands to his sides, projecting indifference.
I don't wish to overstep. I'm here to advise. If the consensus is to alter the agenda, so be it.
Gaborone had been the first to agree to appoint Soren advisor to the 204th. He'd also been the first to aim a rifle at Soren upon his arrival aboard the Airy several weeks prior, accusing him of desertion. For this, too, Soren respected the man. The assembled officers looked to one another. Gaborone finally answered.
Give us the Jarbanoth postmortem first, then we talk about the war. My people want updates.
There were no further direct challenges. They reviewed footage from the Jarbanoth attack, and Soren called Gaborone's second-in-command, Palal Sidia, into the conference to account for her flight's actions. Though it was certainly possible to find fault with the strike, Soren had no desire to make an enemy of Squadron 4. He encouraged both Gaborone and Sidia to lead the discussion, raising concerns only when required. Where Gaborone was a thundercloud of emotion forever portending a storm, Sidia was a stoic save for a hint of arch wit. Slender-bodied and crested by a fuzz of dark hair, voice projected through a medical vocabulator, she defended her flight's actions. When Soren brought up the fuel costs of tight maneuvering, Sidia argued that burdening her pilots with logistical worries could lead to fatal errors. Rather than answer with irritation, Soren agreed that the key was not in arbitrary limitations, but to alter flight patterns in low-risk circumstances. He'd have raised the same objection in her place. He didn't fault her for defending her people. He waited until a good 15 minutes into the discussion before asking why she'd gone out of her way to damage the colony's hazard faults.
We had all the distractions we needed, Soren said. By the time you irradiated the colony, the act itself was unnecessary.
Setting Pandem Nye on fire seemed unnecessary too,
Sidia answered.
Yet the rebels did so without hesitation. Wouldn't you agree?
Lieutenant, Gaborone growled. The concern is Jarbanoth, Soren said, not Pandem Nye.
But he let the jab go. He almost smiled. By the time they'd dissected every shot fired over the Junker world and every errant tie-to-tie transmission, assume that all comm traffic will be recorded, decrypted, and passed on to New Republic intelligence, he warned them, Soren's people were growing restless. He dismissed Sidia and set to fulfilling his earlier promise. News of the war wouldn't lift the commander's spirits, but it wasn't a subject he could avoid forever.
The New Republic propaganda broadcasts are not to be trusted, he told them. But as supporting evidence, they may have been useful. It appears Moff Pandian has indeed been killed, and that his forces have allied with Admiral Ray Sloane.
Sloane's fleet is clearly growing, and she appears to be operating primarily within the Outer Rim. Our technicians aboard the Allegiance have also managed to access a newsfeed operated by former Black Sun agents.
No more reliable a source than Republic propaganda, but with its own slant. Combined with the data banks delivered to us by my Junker friend, we can safely assert that the New Republic is every bit as chaotic as one would expect. Their military supply lines are stretched thin, and pirate and raider attacks are at levels roughly 60 times normal. The Empire's been reduced to pockets of stability, but that stability seems real. Tesso Bruch, Squadron 5's commanding officer, had been staring at the wall during Soren's summary. Now he asked simply, "What about Coruscant?" Major Rassus looked to Soren. Soren waved him to speak. "The system is still blockaded," Rassus said, "but the capital remains untouched by New Republic troops. No word yet from Grand Vizier Ameda." Captain Derrida, Squadron 2's latest commander, offered, "We could break the blockade. Not permanently, but we could make it to Coruscant. Aid in the fight, maybe extract Ameda himself." Gablerone scowled. "If Ameda wanted to get off-world, he'd find a way. One TIE wing can't free Coruscant." "If not Coruscant, what about one of the other territories under siege?" Fesch spoke next, leaning forward across the table. "There's still no news out of Anoat. The sector must be under control. We could pledge our services and end up working for a power-hungry would-be emperor who doesn't give a rip about the galaxy at large." Derrida shook her head brusquely. "I'm not throwing in with some warlord outside the chain of command." "Then pick a target," Fesch cried. "If we're not rejoining the fleet, any fleet, then let's at least do some damage out here." Soren allowed the officers to debate, to sketch plans ranging from the cautious to the absurd in their search for a purpose for the 204th Fighter Wing. He listened without judgment until Rassus asked, "What about the Emperor's messenger? If the droid's with us, it must have orders." Then Soren stood, striking the tabletop with the palm of his hand. "We won't solve this problem today," Soren said, "nor should we try. Until we've recovered our strength and reestablished the unit, planning for the future is a futile gesture." Gablerone's lips were twitching, and even loyal Rassus shifted uncomfortably. But Soren didn't stop. "I suggest we adjourn for the day and resume tomorrow." The officers muttered and cursed, but filed out of the room, edging around the table and knocking shoulders as they made for the door. When the door slid shut, Soren was surprised to find Bruch still present. "Why encourage debate if you won't accept their ideas?" Bruch asked. He was a tall man, with a neatly trimmed beard and a face that seemed to have aged a year for every month since Endor. His voice was mild and puzzled. "They don't trust my ideas yet," Soren said. "If they're going to question me, I'd rather them do it in the open so I can guide them toward, well, toward something that won't get us all killed." Bruch laughed, politely, Soren thought, but with no genuine amusement. Soren had known Bruch long enough to distinguish one from the other. "Give me your judgment," Soren said. "You see the others from a clearer vantage." Bruch sighed, glanced toward the door, then said, "It's not your ideas that are the problem. I don't think anyone here believes they can lead this unit better than you. Hell, it's the only reason you weren't tossed out an airlock." "It's you, Major. You're a problem for them." "Proceed." There was nothing in Soren's voice to comfort or encourage Bruch, nor was it necessary. "You left us," Bruch said. "After Necronus, you told the squadron commanders that the war was lost, that continuing to fight was pointless, and you deserted your unit." There was no rage in Bruch's voice that Soren could perceive, just a scolding, like a parent might deliver to a child caught in a lie. "You offered us a way out, honorable in its way, and I know you were attempting to set an example, but you left us at our lowest moment. And you didn't see what happened at Pandem Nai. You can't understand the pilots who want revenge instead of safety, and they won't understand you." Shakara Nerys was a friend, Sorin thought. I want revenge as much as anyone. But he knew it wasn't true. Leaving Shadow Wing had been a calculated risk. Sorin had moved on to show the others that moving on was not only possible, but necessary for survival. Yet, they had learned nothing from his example, and instead, Sorin had discovered his assumptions had been an error. Leaving the battlefield had not given Sorin a chance at peace. It had isolated him from allies, while the New Republic had hounded him. His unit, meanwhile, had been exposed to the vehement spite of the Empire's old foes. The soldiers of the 204th were wrong to think victory was a possibility, wrong to think revenge could be wrought in any satisfactory way. They were not wrong to think the New Republic would never leave them be. "I appreciate your candor," Sorin said. Bruce grunted. "I'm sure. Is... one other question. What do you think of Lieutenant Cedia?" Bruce arched his brow. "Speaking of revenge, blowing the hazard vaults was a bad idea only she could have pulled off." "High praise." Sorin considered a while, stood, and gestured to the door. "Thank you, Commander. Again, I appreciate your candor." Bruce exited with a brusque nod. He was right about everything. Almost everything. Yet another reason Sorin had to do justice by Shadow Wing. Two. The X-Wing cut a slash across the dark sky, its strike foils closed. Will Lark followed the faint light of its thrusters, fainter than stars under the strange heavens of Troyth, and tried to mimic its dips and spins while maintaining a steady distance. He chased it low among the planet's solar projectors, lower still over the near-invisible atmospheric ripple of the bombardment shield, and then into the upper atmosphere at speeds that left his head aswim and his vision glittering. There, as he leveled out his ship and sucked in cold gasps of oxygen, he was struck by a revelation. He was a better flyer than Erica Quell, but she was the better starfighter pilot.
"Tell me we got the images," he said, "and that we're not making another pass." "Confirming."
If Quell was breathless, Will couldn't tell by her voice.
"CB-9 confirms the cam rig picked up 2,200 images of the target area. Assuming your equipment's functional, we should have 70% coverage."
Will tried to recall the briefing. The target had been 63%.
"Recon's over then?"
he asked. He rubbed at the console as navigational data flashed onto its screens, a course looping them over the planet's northern hemisphere.
"We're taking the long way around,"
Quell said.
"Comm network is glitching today, so better not to pass over even friendly territory. No reason to scare anyone."
"Happy that,"
Will said. He didn't need an explanation. He was glad for the excuse to soar. He hadn't left Troyth since the mission in the debris field, spending the past few days skirting rooftops and eluding surface-to-air missiles and shooting walkers. He'd escorted Kairos' transport through Cybersynth district foundries and drained his batteries, obliterating 15 stories of Glamir Tower, crawling with stormtroopers. Flying was a pure joy. As if she understood his thoughts, Quell asked,
"You enjoying the break?"
"More than anything,"
he said, though he was surprised to hear her ask. She'd never been given to unnecessary conversation, in or out of the cockpit.
"Thanks for bringing me out here."
They sped 84 kilometers above the surface through a cloudless sky. With a gentle dip of one wing, Will could bring the vast cityscape into view. It wasn't as undifferentiated as it appeared from orbit. Instead, splotched with darkness where power grids had failed, banded in different geometric patterns where architectural styles had shifted during the millennia of the city's expansion, compressed where underlying mountain ranges or waterways or deserts had forced the colonizers to adapt. tinted with beryl or rose or jade, depending on peculiarities of the solar projectors and pollution emitted by local industries, baking color into the composite metals of the metropolis.
I meant the whole campaign,
Quell said. Will's thoughts crumbled apart like a clod of dirt from a drought-parched plain.
Come again?
She spoke with obvious consideration.
I don't mean to say things are easy. I know you're working hard as ever. And this operation has its challenges, with Vanguard Squadron out of system and the need to appear vulnerable without losing outright. Add coordinating intelligence with Aiden, and it's a lot of moving parts. But compared with everything in the run-up to Pandem Nigh, compared with the Auradol Cluster, or before Endor,
it's different,
Will admitted. He kept his tone gentle. He didn't want her to feel challenged or disbelieved, but he was genuinely puzzled by this turn in the conversation. He glimpsed distant shimmering as they passed beyond the edge of the planetary deflector shields. The cityscape was severed by a dark ocean and replaced on the far side of the channel by a bleak expanse of rock. Lightning lit patchy clouds like gaseous obsidian. Here and there was the flash of something metallic, though whether he saw structures or merely stone polished to a sheen, he was unsure. This was the scar of Troyth, a continent torn apart by mining machines, carved and honeycombed and chiseled until what was left lacked even the harsh beauty of a lifeless planetoid. Will tamped down instinctive revulsion. Such devastation was anathema to the ways of home, and reminded himself, you find beauty in the city. This is the price these people paid, a graft of their world's skin, lifted from one site to sculpt another.
We haven't lost a ship in 15 days,
Quell said.
Not us, not Meteor Squadron, not Hale. General Syndulla suggested we might set a record.
He leaned into his seat and pitched his ship so that he could no longer see the landscape.
You're right,
he said.
You're absolutely right. I'll still be ready for all this to end.
He found himself wanting to talk to her, to confess that every night he found it harder to dream of home, and that he'd intended to leave the New Republic before Shadow Wing had murdered his friends. That he wanted to leave now and couldn't. She was talking, however, and he made himself listen.
I've been where you are now. I used to fly escort on bombing runs all the time. You watch what happens, and there's only so much you can do. But you fight to protect your comrades in the air. I was at McTrotty, Will.
There was a long pause. The galaxy seemed upside down, with darkness below and the blazing starlight of the deep core above. Will felt irritable and guilty at his own confusion. He remembered the destruction of the rebel outpost on McTrotty from the Shadow Wing files, realized there was meaning in Quill's words, yet couldn't discern what meaning that was. Ask her. If she's coming to you for support, ask her.
What happened at McTrotty?
He asked. But he'd waited too long.
Nothing,
Quell said, and they flew on through the endless night. If there was a history of the Thanner House district worth knowing, it wasn't in the droid-generated tactical summaries sent to Will and the rest of the squadron. The district was old, at least. Its borders were defined by the shores of the Thanner Lake, a massive reservoir so buried by towers, bridges, and platforms that it was invisible from orbit. From afar, the only evidence the lake existed were the massive pipes climbing housing blocks and the saucer-like balconies shaped like antique Mon Cala sea skimmers. These last, Will supposed, were affectations of the wealthy. The residents had been warned for 3 days that New Republic forces would be moving through the district. Broadcasting the plan entailed little risk. By now, Governor Hastemore and his army had surely realized that General Syndulla and her forces were coming for him, and the direct path led through Thanner House, And the notice was delivered hourly via radio broadcast and orbital flare. Civilians were advised to evacuate or, as the time of the attack approached, to locate blast shelters and stockpile supplies. In most of the previously targeted districts, evacuation warnings had resulted in kilometer-long trails of refugees making for New Republic territory. In Thanner House, for whatever reason, the residents remained put. Maybe it was out of loyalty to Governor Hastemore's rule. Maybe it was out of fear of the same. Either way, Alphabet Squadron was expected to escort the infantry caravan and provide air support in the event of a ground skirmish. Meteor Squadron was 20 minutes away in case of emergency, but Recon suggested the district would fall without serious opposition, and Alphabet's mixture of fighters and bombers, along with the U-Wing transport, made it a surprisingly effective complement to mid-sized ground detachments. "We've found your calling," General Syndulla had joked before takeoff. So they flew among the spires of the Thanner House district, observing the lambent sunset of tower lights while speeder bikes scouted paths far below. They listened to Chass's collection of Verpine pipe glass.
"My droid has better range and melody,"
Nath declared, as hover tanks and stolen juggernauts rumbled after the speeders, packed with infantry squads spilling out onto their roofs and leaving trails of fluttering ration pack wrappers like spore. When the first blast came, the thunder of Will's engine and the barrier of his canopy rendered it nearly inaudible. But he knew it for what it was by the screams over his comm. It was a panicked minute before anyone located the attackers. The energy blast that had melted a juggernaut and incinerated 59 passengers had come from below, not from a bomber or a gargantuan AT-AT walker, but from something below the surface of the water. A second beam erupted seconds later, then a third and fourth. The particle streams caused boiling geysers to erupt, scattered defenseless New Republic soldiers, and cut through buildings a kilometer above ground. Whatever was below didn't aim for the starfighters, but that made their beams no less deadly.
"Astromech calculating beam trajectories, attempting to locate their points of origin,"
Quell called.
"Can't get a sensor reading, but it looks like we've got 6 aquatic combat vehicles down there."
"Kraken class deep lurkers,"
Chass muttered.
"Seen them before."
Will's screens flashed as data from Quell's X-Wing streamed to his console. He checked his weapons loadout and tried to do the math.
"They're too far underwater. Concussion missiles won't penetrate that far."
"Take Kairos and go,"
Quell snapped.
"Get out of range, above the solar projectors. Neither of you is useful here."
Will growled and jerked his control yoke, pulling the A-Wing away from a beam that left a molten streak across the facade of a corporate tower. For an instant, he thought it was raining. As Quell called orders and Will danced among the beams, his mind processed the droplets beating against his canopy, and he realized that the enemy had punctured the massive water tanks, drawing off the lake water. He was flying through a windless storm, navigating by instruments alone, attempting to escape the spray and find a purpose for his ship, a purpose for the death machine that could do nothing for the troops on the ground or his squadron in the sky. "The battle didn't last 10 minutes, Will said. He stood in the Lodestar's observation deck, staring out at the peeling red paint of the maintenance bay and clutching the recorder in one hand. His voice was low, though that was a needless precaution. No one was up and about in that part of the battleship so late. "The lurkers were heavily armed, but their plating wasn't any thicker than a walker's. We owe the win to Chass and Nath, mostly." He described it as he remembered, and maybe, mostly, as it had occurred. Chass had broadcast a Snivian rhythm rhyme as she'd descended. Nath had struggled to pitch his Y-Wing toward the ground without crashing. But they'd both launched guided bombs through gaps in the broken grating above the lake and annihilated the enemy below. Kairos had ignored Quell's command to get clear, instead evacuating ground troops clinging to shattered streets or caught by waves of boiling water. Kairos packed 30 soldiers aboard her ship, he said, clasping the holo recorder between both hands. People are scared of her. You don't know much about her, but I've never met anyone who fought harder to keep her allies alive. When it was over, and I got clear of the spray and looked around, his voice was soft and calm. There was water everywhere, spilling from the tanks and the pipes, running down the buildings, kicked up from the bomb blasts. Someone had broken the dams, and I could hear the water rushing out. It takes a lot of water to hear over an A-Wing's engines. We did a quick pass to check for other enemies, but we didn't find any. We listened to the ground troops checking in, and Quell told us we'd done well. We'd kept casualties low under the circumstances. Chas laughed and said, "If you sign up to be a ground pounder, you know what you're in for. If you're in the first wave, something's going to kill you." She didn't mean it to be callous. We've all seen people get hurt. After we finished with the aerial pass, I sat down just to see if we could lend a hand. Water had washed out whole floors of the big towers. One of them's bound to collapse from the damage, and that'll probably take down others. In a year, the whole district will be ruins rising out of a lake. Nath sat down too, and we looked for anyone to rescue. I asked him, "Why are we doing this?" And he knew what I meant. We were wading through thigh-high water, searching for missing troops. "We get the capital, we get Shadow Wing," he said. They would do it too. Will didn't know what would happen when Shadow Wing came, but he was confident they would take the capital. He'd seen enough of Troyth to realize that there was no defense Governor Hastemore and the Imperial forces could erect that would stop the New Republic. All the enemy could do was delay the inevitable, to force the expenditure of lives for every meter gained. Long ago, Will had been part of Riot Squadron. He and his colleagues fighting for the Rebel Alliance had seen more losses than wins. They had wept together and danced after missions no one would ever remember. Missions only Will was alive to remember. "We're fighting a different war now," he told the holo recorder, "and I'm feeling a little sick." In the early days after Will had left home, he had often written to the elders of his birthplace, Cliff. He'd asked about the righteousness of killing and how to mourn his enemies without betraying his duty. He'd reaffirmed his commitment to fighting until the Emperor was defeated and home was free. He'd been unable to receive answers, but it had been enough to quiet his mind. Now he envisioned the recipient of his message, not an elder of home, but a more nebulous figure, replying. He heard a voice smooth and low, backed by static, and neither evidently male nor female. The voice was exactly as he had heard it months earlier, and it showed no sympathy for Will's plight. "What do you think a soldier is for, Will Lark?" He found nothing else to say. Nothing more he wanted to confess, even knowing that the message would never leave his recorder. He squeezed a button with his thumb and erased the data, as he had every time he'd prepared to contact Blink, his friend and enemy. Blink, the anonymous pilot of the 204th Fighter Wing. Blink, who had killed Riot Squadron in the Auradol cluster and helped save a planet at Pandem Nigh. Even in his imagination, the Shadow Wing pilot would offer no escape from the ocean of blood Will swam through. Blink wouldn't listen, and the elders of home would never understand. Three. Soren Keyes dropped from the sphere of his tie onto the hangar deck, listening to utter silence as his boots impacted the metal plating. He checked the seal on his helmet through the numbing thickness of his gloves and eyed the gauges on his chest plate in the dim emergency lighting. He wouldn't have nearly enough oxygen to explore the entire vessel, but then he didn't have much time anyway.
"Keys in position,"
he announced.
"Minimal life support.
Atmosphere, 12% expected density. No alarms. Status outside?
Squadron 5 is chasing the last of the Rebel escorts.
Major Rassus's answer was crisp and curt.
They're no threat, but escape is a possibility. Bruce is ready to trap the Bantha if we need to pursue through hyperspace.
No,
Sorin said. He thought of the Ares' journey through the Auradal cluster, pursuing a Rebel frigate in the depths of Oblivion. He'd spoken to the pilots involved, heard stories of the enemy picking off hardened warriors as they'd raced through hellish alien landscapes.
I want to be done as swiftly as possible. Gone by the time Rebel reinforcements arrive.
He strode through the hangar, testing the tug of artificial gravity and passing a dozen other ties as Rassus spoke to someone aboard the cruiser carrier. Sorin studied the vessels in the gloom, noting the red-painted cockpit hatches and the bulky machinery half-visible through their viewports. Drone fighters, every one.
What about squadrons 2 and 4?
Sorin asked when the murmuring on the comm ceased.
Still performing flybys, per your recommendation.
Not your instructions, Sorin noticed.
No activity spotted, though Lieutenant Cedia says she saw a light go dark in Section 14. Could be a glitch, even if it were real.
Cedia doesn't strike me as a woman prone to imagining things,
Sorin said.
Don't you agree?
There was a short pause.
I wouldn't know. We've never spoken.
Then leave the judgment to me, Sorin thought.
Patch me into Squadron 5,
he said.
I'd like to listen while I look around.
The ensuing chatter was crisp and professional, targeting assignments and missile lock warnings and gruff words of approval from a commander to his pilots. Sorin found it soothing as he moved out of the hangar and into the arteries of the Star Destroyer Edict. They'd come searching for the ship, guided by little more than hope. The Edict had been a wreck even before the Battle of Endor, a vessel past its prime, assigned to training missions and war games and stripped to its core components. It was, Sorin had known, one of relatively few destroyers that could have escaped engagement during the weeks after the Emperor's death. If anyone had remembered its existence, he hadn't at the time. They certainly wouldn't have considered its retrieval a priority. Through guesswork and the careful exchange of intelligence with less than trustworthy sources, he'd managed to locate the Edict under New Republic Guard in the desolate expanse of the Pormthulis system. Whether these efforts would prove profitable, he wasn't yet certain. The corridors were dark, but no dust swam in the rays of his glow rod. Sorin unsealed blast doors and rerouted emergency power to turbo lifts, navigating the labyrinth as he wended toward Section 14. He permitted himself a smile when Squadron 5's Commander Bruce declared the last of the Rebel forces destroyed, but he said nothing. Section 14 was primarily devoted to crew habitation, bunk rooms and messes and supply stations, with a scattered few turbo lasers and point defense cannons set into exterior bulkheads. Sorin saw no indication that the area was in use, no unexpected power distribution, no sealed-off atmosphere, not even a tray out of place in the galley. He adjusted his comm as he walked.
Keys to Cedia, can you pinpoint the exact location of the activity you saw in Section 14?
Negative.
Static cut through the reply, but with Sorin's helmet set to amplify and broadcast, it echoed even in the thin corridor air.
Would you like me to make another pass?
No need. If we have allies aboard, I have no wish to frighten them. If we have enemies, I will die with few regrets. Should I abruptly cut contact, open fire.
Understood,
Cedia said. But Sorin was no longer listening to her. The crew emerged slowly, like feral animals approaching a potential source of food and warmth. They crawled out of maintenance shafts and supply closets, wearing scuffed and grease-stained uniforms, along with rebreathers and oxygen packs. Most wore cadet insignia and had an air of youthful uncertainty. Three were noticeably older, white-haired or entirely bald. 20 in total surrounded Sorin, blocking the corridor in both directions.
You hid from the New Republic?
Soren asked. He directed his question to a bejeweled captain who fingered a blaster pistol. He did not raise his voice.
If you're asking why we didn't fight,
the captain began irritably.
No. Given your circumstances, you might have breached protocol. But adaptability is no flaw in a soldier. Did you hide? We did.
The captain nodded to someone behind Soren, perhaps indicating to one of the cadets to back away. Or come closer. Soren didn't turn his head.
But I don't appreciate being questioned by a TIE pilot. I don't fly much nowadays.
Soren waited for a laugh, or at least a raised brow, but none came. He continued.
I'm Major Soren Keyes, special advisor to the 204th Imperial Fighter Wing. We are diminished, as you have been, but we came here to bolster our unit.
He paused, watching the survivors of the edict, and grateful that his helmet hid his expression. He'd hoped that the ship would be abandoned, or better yet, crewed by naval officers hardened after months of fighting and already evolving to fight a war in dire straits. Instead, he'd found children and their nursemaids. They would tax his resources instead of contributing. All he really needed was their ship.
If you wish to join us,
he said,
you would be welcome.
It turned out the edict was drifting through the Pormthula system rather than being disassembled in a New Republic salvage yard because its hyperdrive had been offline for weeks. The edict's crew had been unable to mend it without a replacement generator, reactant agitator injector, coaxium suspension element, and 28 Imperial standard sealing bolts. The New Republic, upon capturing the Star Destroyer, had also been unwilling or unable to effect repairs. Thus, it fell to Soren Keyes to sacrifice the cruiser carrier Allegiance so that the edict might live. The Allegiance had served the 204th well, but no one questioned the wisdom of the decision. The carrier's engine was disabled and disassembled, its parts gingerly guided down zero-gravity corridors into the hangar, out the magnetic field, and directly into the maw of the edict. Under Soren's supervision, the cadets and their superiors proved that they possessed a measure of competence after all. Restoring main power and light-speed capability to the Star Destroyer within 6 hours. The entire process reminded Soren of Devon's life aboard the White Drift Exchange, where Devon had partnered with young Richten under the Harch to repair drive systems and malfunctioning thrusters and 100 other problems with 1,000 classes of starship. He was surprised by the ferocity of his desire to shove his hands into the Star Destroyer's guts. He was surprised he hadn't wondered where Richten was before now, and wondered if he'd made a mistake sending the boy away. But perhaps Richten had a future ahead of him yet. He had been Imperial, but hadn't done the deeds Shadow Wing had. After the disabled Allegiance had been stripped and obliterated by Squadron 3, the carrier's captain Rogart still objected, but sentiment was a burden the 204th could not carry forever. And Airy and Edict had escaped from danger into the cerulean storm of hyperspace, Soren suggested a celebration to welcome the 204th's newest members and the addition of the Star Destroyer to the growing battle group. It did not go as he planned.
Andara has fallen, Candende declared, tipping the bottle of wine and letting the liquid spill from his lips onto the collar of his uniform and down to the tabletop on which he stood. The New Republic declares victory once again, and we...
Gaborone grabbed the young pilot by the ankles and tossed him from table to floor with impressive speed, but the damage had been done before the drunken toast. Soren could finish the sentiment himself, and we celebrate having recovered a training vessel crewed by children. The news had spread before the celebration in the Ares hangar bay. Rather than a crowd of festive soldiers sharing a precious supply of wine and enhanced meal rations, Sorin was faced with a grim-faced gang of squadron commanders and those pilots and crew who'd failed to find busy work elsewhere.
"Is that true about Andara?"
the bejoweled instructor from the Edict, Sorin had learned the man's name was Horatio Nenves, asked. Sorin deliberately turned away from Gaborone's harsh discipline of Candende.
"That's the claim being aired on the propaganda networks. We'll need to confirm, but it does seem likely."
"Bastards!"
Nenves spat.
"You intend to strike back?"
"If Andara is lost, direct retaliation wins us nothing. We'll continue rebuilding the wing, hitting targets as opportunity allows."
"Rebuilding for what purpose?"
Nenves scoffed.
"While we grow stronger, the rest of the Empire is crumbling."
"We can't save the rest of the Empire," Sorin thought. "We can save ourselves."
"Rebuilding so that when an opportunity arises, we may take full advantage of it."
Nenves stared at Sorin a while and then, with a curt nod, stalked away. In the old days, aboard the Pursuer, Sorin would have left the celebration. He would have sought out the pilots and crew who hadn't joined in, squatted next to them as they stripped engine coils or tested cannon chargers, and silently assisted until they admitted what troubled them. That had always been his method, and he was tempted to leave the celebration now. But being second in command to Colonel Nares had given him cover he no longer had. He had called this celebration, and if he walked out, he would be abandoning those who'd come, as well as lose what credibility he'd earned with the wing's leadership.
"See to your people,"
he murmured in passing to the squadron commanders present. They understood the message, each quietly gathering their own soldiers before departing. Dorita hissed,
"Fix this!"
to him as she went. Sorin was left with the crew of the Edict and those from the Aerie and Allegiance who had lacked the sense to stay out of sight.
"Come,"
he called, sitting on an empty battery crate.
"Let's tell our stories about Andara and about the Allegiance. If this is going to be a funeral, we'll do it right."
They did tell stories. Not pilot stories, but stories about repairing a power conduit on the Allegiance as Pandem Nye burned, or about taking leave on Andara after the death of a sister. Sorin stayed silent. His place was to listen, not to dominate. But he remembered his own brief encounter with Andara's security forces when he had been young and foolish. A month before his entrance into the Academy, and he'd almost earned an arrest record that would have kept him out of the Imperial Navy forever.
"We can't let them keep winning,"
Crete said. She was a veteran of the 204th, but no older than 21. She spoke with a thick Twi'lek accent that Sorin imagined had earned considerable mockery during her training among the ground crews.
"You've seen what is out there, Major. They think they've already won, do they not?"
"They do," Sorin admitted. "Are they wrong?"
"We need to show them they haven't, even if we are to bide our time."
He could see Crete fumbling with the language. The others were watching her.
"We owe the people of Andara. We need to be showing them all that people are still fighting, fighting for them. Fighting for the Empire."
"We will,"
Sorin said.
"We are."
The answer satisfied none of them, but they nodded.
"Tell us,"
Crete said,
"what it's like under their rule."
He wasn't keen to discuss his time as Devon, but it was better than promising vengeance and bloodshed, and he gave his audience the truth, that the New Republic was a government that did not know how to govern. And that while scattered worlds might revel in their newfound freedom, more were suffering from food shortages and societal breakdown and criminal activity. He told them about Marinzabon and Tinkertown, where he had met an Imperial who'd fallen prey to the same corruption afflicting the rebels. A small, petty man who preyed on impoverished locals to enrich himself and his companions. Sorin found himself weeping gently as he told the story, though he hadn't wept at the news of Andara. He did not hide his emotion, and the others watched him with the gravity of youth as he described Gannery, the cantina owner who had befriended him, his students in Tinkertown who had learned to fight for their own survival when someone, the Empire, the New Republic, should have been protecting them. And when he was asked again, "When will we show them we still fight?" he said, "Tomorrow." The next day, he scanned star charts and tactical maps and chose a target. He persuaded the commanders one by one, and they flew to Mon Gaza, where Sorin knew from his travels that the New Republic was establishing a planetary outpost. They reduced it to dust with particle cannons and proton torpedoes. They walked among wreckage and corpses to make sure that nothing was left undone, nor any evidence left behind. And Sorin allowed an anonymous pilot to scrawl in the ashes, "For Andara." He doubted anyone would find it. After he had showered, 2 minutes only, as water was still in short supply, he swept dirt and ash into the drain and sat in his office to review the latest intelligence skimmed from open comm feeds. This was not his specialty. He lacked the expertise of a dedicated analyst. But who else was available? He browsed headers, satisfied that nothing regarding the capture of the edict had made it into the public conversation, and paused when he reached a file of corrupted half-messages sent on coded Imperial channels. There were the usual desperate cries for help from outposts under siege by entire New Republic fleets, but one, earmarked with an obsolete encryption code once used by the 204th, caught his attention. A message from the Cerberon system. He read the sections that had not decayed to gibberish with interest. He read it again and pulled up files on Cerberon, its worlds, and its military significance. If his people insisted on risking their lives for a war already lost, the least he could do was give them a battle worth winning. Four. Chasna Chaddick didn't have her ship, but she still had a mission. She tried to comfort herself with that fact as the U-Wing's deck bucked beneath her and wind blasted her through the open loading door. "You could be back at base," she told herself. "You could be dragging your butt through the refugee camp looking for a deck of cards. Or death sticks. You volunteered for this because this job didn't need another bomber." But as the ship rocked and she wedged the toe of her left boot into a seam to keep from falling a kilometer onto pavement, she couldn't bring herself to feel grateful. She shouted a curse at Kairos, one the pilot certainly wouldn't hear over the buffeting air, and pressed her face to the turret scope.
"Problems above?"
The question came through her headset. Sound vibrated through the ill-fitting earpieces raking her horns, worsening her temper. She couldn't remember the name of the speaker, one of the infantry troops, name of Vitali.
"Ignore our girl, Chas,"
Nath's voice answered.
"She's not in a happy mood."
"Don't condescend to me, you surly bastard," Chas would have said, but she was wrestling the turret barrel into position, squinting to get a magnified glimpse of the street below. Parked speeders, uncollected garbage, occasional barricades that had to have been assembled by civilians. She hoped the computer-assisted aim would pick up anything she was missing. A walker could flash by and she might not notice. The job was recon. Fly into enemy territory a few clicks ahead of the ground troops and scout the sectors nearest the capital. Scan for the governor's forces and identify a path to the shield generators. Chas risked a glance up at the faint shimmer in the sky, where the planetary deflector refracted the burning iris of the black hole. They'd entered below the energy field, but so close to the ground that a single stormtrooper with a plex rocket could take them down. For the real assault to begin, New Republic forces would need to bring bombers into play. That meant eliminating the shields before anything else. She spied the flash of a hovermine floating midway up the side of a tower, blocking a side street. She called it in.
Ground team!
Quell called.
You have enough to work with. They've likely spotted the U-Wing by now, even with the baffles and jammers on. One more pass along the tram line and I'll feel more comfortable.
The woman on the ground replied.
Sending a route to the pilot now.
Chas felt the U-Wing's thrusters transfer power a millisecond before her field of view shifted. The transport banked and turned. She captured images of the tram line and the barricades, real barricades this time, duracrete and energy fields erected along its length, spotted stormtrooper patrols in the distance marching through the streets. She felt her cheeks and nose go numb from the wind and spun the turret around, making an obscene gesture into the recorder lens before returning to the work.
Charming,
Quell said.
You love it. Just make sure you get the images. Come on, Lieutenant, you know I'm good for it. If you two are done flirting...
Vitali interrupted.
Be grateful.
Chas snarled, suddenly self-conscious. She didn't mind Alphabet listening, but strangers were another matter.
We're doing this work so you don't get killed. And we're going to get killed, why exactly? Why are we rushing into the capital instead of starving the governor out?
Chas knew better than to mention Shadowwing on an insecure channel. But not mentioning the trap didn't keep the thought from flashing through her head, and she shifted restlessly.
Leave the speculation for another day,
Quell said curtly.
Finish up and head home.
The U-Wing adjusted course again, and Chas moved on wobbling, widespread legs toward the loading door's control panel. She slapped it hard and leaned against the bulkhead as the door began to slide shut. Bastards, she muttered, and her mind lingered on Shadow Wing, on Blink and Char and Puke flying through the clouds of the Auradol cluster. The clouds of Auradol became the flames of Pandem Nigh, as something erupted and thunder shook the transport. Chas was launched across the cabin. She turned her head in time to avoid breaking her nose against the far bulkhead, but her cheek hit hard and the studs of her horns were driven back into her skull through her left temple. Heat surged at her back, and when she twisted around, she saw shards of rocket casing burning on the deck and the crew seats afire. The loading door had finished closing, but rattled worryingly.
We're hit,
Chas called. She smelled melting plastoid and fabric as smoke rose from the seats. She felt a flash of pain as her nostrils flared.
In case you didn't notice.
The U-Wing accelerated, abandoning all pretense of stealth. Chas could only guess that they were running from their attackers. She swallowed a mouthful of smoke and stumbled away from the wall, kneeling and fumbling at floor panels in search of the emergency compartment. She jerked at a handle, yanked with frustration until a plate came loose, and she was able to retrieve the fire extinguisher. 2 minutes later, the flames were out, and Chas had kicked most of the rocket shrapnel into a corner. She stuck her head into the cockpit long enough to confirm that Kairos was alive and on course, but the masked woman acknowledged her with nothing more than a glance and a nod. Nice that you were worried, Chas said, and returned to the main cabin. When she went to return the extinguisher to the emergency compartment, she saw the trophies. In the chaos of the fire, she hadn't noticed them, but they were lined neatly against the sides of the emergency compartment, tacked in place with adhesive. On one side were Imperial rank pins and comlinks, and something it took Chas a moment to recognize as a cracked optical lens from a stormtrooper's helmet.